So let's begin with some small mangala chants and words of blessings, and let's do invite spontaneously our dear Samanat some words of blessing. You're already holding the cup in your hand, so give us to drink some words of blessing to have a blessed gathering today.
Okay. I pray to Srila Prabhupada and Parampara. I pray to Gaur-Nitai and to all forms and names of God to bless this Q&E and to give us the wisdom and insight to harmonize what we understand as we understand it. And to come closer to you and to come closer to each other. Hare Krishna.
Beautiful. Thanks so much, Sam, for reminding us of what we are supposed to be doing here and preparing our hearts to be better. I mean, better crafted vessels. The crafting never ends, so we can always craft and refine and polish and strengthen the Kripa Patra, sometimes is described in our tradition, right? The mercy vessel. That's a way that our tradition speaks about the heart. The heart is a mercy vessel to host the descent of grace that sometimes can descend quite powerfully. So we need to develop an equal power to survive the descent of grace. No, aggressive grace, fierce grace, in the good sense of aggressiveness, of course, right? In the good sense of something being ferocious, something that wants to give itself to us in a very abundant way, in a very deep way, in a very real way. And again, if we are not accustomed to deal with things being abundant and deep and real, we may feel it's too much. So basically, it's sadhana, and this meeting is part of our sadhana, has to do with that, with gaining awareness of the ongoing, the work in progress that we all are, and we will always be, in terms of developing more and more spaciousness and depth and breadth to host a new flavor, a new version, new layer of grace there. Grace is always up to date and constantly updating itself to a new descent in our lives. So for some reason, that's why we are meeting every single week, and we are not saying, okay, 1 week is enough and that's it. We don't need to get together again. And we need to continue working on our Kripa Patra. And as you say, some beautifully also the two, I cannot quote you directly, but whatever we receive, trying to process what we are receiving, right? And trying to work on the content that is coming. It's not just being here receiving something and that's it, but reflecting back, internalizing, playing itself out in relationship. Yeah. Thank you. So welcome each one of you one more time. We can never say welcome enough. We can always welcome each other and ourselves and everything and everyone on deeper and deeper levels of welcoming to participate in deeper and deeper ways in reality. And we are again in satsang, right? Satsang basically means encounters with the truth, right? That's what sadhu sangha creates. Satsang is not just like a social weekly circle, but satsanga is something that is facilitated by sadhu sangha, by being in company with one another, hopefully by getting attached sangha to become honest with one another. And that creates satsang, an encounter with the truth. And the possibility of seeing ourselves new and new again. How do I look when I dare to encounter with the truth? I dare to show up, because truth is all-pervading, omnipresent. But as we say, sometimes we may be very expert in becoming omni-absent to that which is all-pervasive. So encounters with the truth. How the truth is encountering me today? And how do I allow to be encountered by the truth? And what's the truth telling me today? And how I'm being invited to grow, to change, to transform, to adopt a new form, new version of me, shed the old skin, and becoming all that I can become today, March 21st, 2026. At least for those who are not in New Zealand. If not March 22nd. But still, the invitation is the same for all of us. So, welcome. And as you know, or those who do not know, if you have anything to share today, an inquiry, an exploration, we are on a quest and exploration here, adventure, you can raise your digital hand like some of you already did, and we eventually will try to address each one of your offerings, hopefully trying to honor and reciprocate accordingly. So we have three digital hands raised so far. So we'll begin there with the first one, which is we have our two Kanupriyas. So first one, I'll clarify, is Kanupriya from who lives in Scotland. She's not from Scotland, but she lives in Scotland. And then we'll go to Kanupriya, who is from Germany and lives in Germany. Welcome. You can unmute yourself, Kanupriya. The first one.
Hare Krishna, and
Beautiful.
thank you for giving again the opportunity to ask question. This is really wonderful, and I appreciate it so much. So I have written down my question. Maybe the best thing is if I read it, that is easier also because of my language.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was with the question of God and his unimaginable greatness. I searched for an image that would answer this question, and I received the following inner picture. So the inner picture is, God is like a pomegranate tree. He is the tree on which countless fruits hang. Each of these apples symbolizes one of his manifestations. The one we know may be the best, we know as Radha Krishna. Another one is Sitaram or Lakshmi Narayan, and so on. But also the God of Christians, Sufis, other religions, and traditions. There are pomegranates that we know better than others. And there are countless others that we do not know at all because we cannot comprehend the greatness of God. For a certain reason, we feel particularly attracted to one of the apples, and we want to taste this one apple. We know that there is this one apple that is especially sweet for us. Our pomegranate is that of Radha Krishna Bhakti. Other souls are attracted to other apples, but they are all equal, for they are all God Himself. They are all God's offer to us souls to connect with Him or them. They are all an offer of a way home, different and yet the same, because they all belong to him. When we cut open a pomegranate, we find many seeds inside. They symbolize diversity even within a single apple. Radha Krishna Bhakti has so many colors and moods. Countless such seeds belong to the same apple. The seeds are like the microcosm within the macrocosm. As souls, we can find our microcosm in the knowledge that the macrocosm exists. We can realize that diversity is what defines God. We do not have to be at home in all the seeds of the one apple. We will find our home in one of the seeds. This also means that we do not have to compare all the other apples on the tree with our apple. Each apple is different, and that is how he wants it to be. What we can also recognize is that even within the same apple, there are so many different seeds or rasas that makes the apple so rich. God's greatness and his love of diversity is evident even in a single apple in many different ways. Because even in one apple, the taste is not just one, but there are countless different tastes. Because the other apples on the tree symbolize other aspects of God, we do not have to compare them to our apple, nor do we have to try to make them identical. They are completely different moods and they are different ways home. Everything belongs to God's diversity. Everything is allowed to be. Everything is right. Everything is precious. Everything is exactly as He wants it to be. We do not have to evaluate our own apple or compare it to other apples. We can simply marvel at God's greatness and become humble. So my question would be, would you agree with this analogy of that every aspect of God has almost at the very end their own realm and offers a separate way, and that all these relationships we are offered are not the same, but equal. I mean, equal in value. So we know that there is a different taste in every relationship, but I always feel I hear so often also in on that path, there is always still this saying or mood, we have the best. Yes, we have the best for ourselves, but I feel always a bit sad if I hear that because I feel there is so much offering from God in a way we can connect or we can at the end serve. And I feel every of this offer is so precious. And I would love to hear your thoughts, Maharaj, about.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Kanupriya. And we had an email exchange with Kanupriya some days ago regarding the pomegranate tree analogy, and I invited her, or she also asked, to bring it to the collective table so we can share all together about this reflection and this important topic. So, yeah, of course, in general, I agree with your analogy. I mean, it's as much as I will say, it's as much as an analogy can convey about infinity, right? Analogies are limited, right? It's an analogy, so they cannot convey the fullness of what the analogy is trying to illustrate. But at the same time, we see so often in all scriptures and traditions that there is a need of analogy to at least have an idea of what we are trying to say. Because again, if not just trying to say anything about the infinite is overwhelming. Where to start, where to begin, anything I will say is never enough. So one option is total silence forever. Another option is trying to say as much as I can in the best way possible, and at the same time remain humbled and aware that I'm just touching one point of infinity. So this is one of those examples, an analogy that is as accurate as it can get, while still, of course, we are not reducing the infinite to a pomegranate tree, of course. But just drawing from elements of nature that we can relate to, and from there draw to ideas that go beyond the analogy itself, right? So yeah, I appreciate the fact that you mentioned, first of all, okay, we have these different fruits, and each fruit could be, again, following the idea of an analogy, compared to an expression of the divine, of the infinite, of the mystery, if we want to use that word, which I like because it's humbling. No, you are reminded it's a mystery at the end of the day. It's not ineffable. In English, they have this word ineffable, which means you cannot say anything about God. I wouldn't say that, but I would say we can never say enough about the divine. Even when we say we cannot say enough about him, which I heard you referring to God repeatedly as he, and not only you, most of us sometimes we say he, and even saying he is limiting, right? So I myself, when I write, have that problem. Okay, I write mostly about God, and we tend to say he. That's kind of the cultural baggage we carry. And sometimes I think, okay, I will put she. to balance the equation of so much many times toxic patriarchy projected onto the divine. Or I can put they, but also any word I use, it's still limiting. Right? If I say she, yes, she, but not only she, and not only she in the way I think of she. He, yes, he, but not only he, and not only he in the way I think of he. They, yeah, not only they, but not only they as two. It can be a two, a couple, it can be a trinity, it can be a no. So shall I put it? Yeah, okay, but again, so at the end of the day, you find struggling with words, and no word can fully convey, which is, I think, is a healthy point to arrive. Like you're trying to use your faculties as much as you can till they collapse, and you realize, wow, there's something beyond all this. So I appreciated that you, first of all, in your analogy and your attempt to do as much as you can to form a picture, a visual image of what we are of this abstract idea, so to say. Okay, each fruit is a form of the divine, and there are endless fruits. In this case, we are talking about an unlimited pomegranate tree, because generally any tree bears a number of fruits, but they cannot. We don't want to talk about the tree bearing endless fruits. So in this case, there are endless forms of the divine. And Bhagavatam uses the word asankhya, which means uncountable. So if you cannot count something, it's basically infinite. And we may say, yeah, it's Krishna, Lakshmi, Narayan, Sitaram. We may just refer to the ones we know. Or we may even go beyond and say, yeah, I'm the God of Christianity and the God of Sufism. Yeah. But there are so many others that we have no clue. And we will never have a clue, probably, because we are dealing with the infinite. So it's, I think it's important for us to enter those spaces on a daily basis, to be humbled and not fall into this type of religious certainty that sometimes goes into religious, as you say, elitism, or as I like to say, racism, not racism, racism, to be racist in the context of rasa, right? My rasa is the best. This rasa is the best. The rasa conveyed my guru, my lineage, my tradition is the topmost. Yeah, the best for you. No. I will summarize my reply to you in this beautiful line from Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where he says something to the effect of every devotee thinks his connection with God is the best, and everyone is right. Everyone is correct. Like very non-sectarian. Very open and very inviting for everyone to validate your own experience. You have this particular, as you say, taste for this particular apple, and that's your favorite fruit. Go for it. That's beautiful. That's great. But some others have a different tongue, a different flavor, and they don't like apple that much or pomegranate that much, so to say. And so they will have a taste for another fruit, for another flavor. But it's all in the same tree. It's all rooted in the same tattva, as the Bhagavatam will say, in the same reality, in the same non-dual reality. That's as non-sectarian as you can get. How the Srimad Bhagavatam begins almost in the beginning, not immediately in the beginning, but it's there. No? Tattvam jnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdyate. Vedanti tattvavidas. Bhagavatam say the seer, the knowers of truth, have spoken about reality as non-dual consciousness. So it's one thing. It's one wholesome, integrated thing. That's reality. You cannot say better, worse, black and white. We usually bring all those dualities into our ways of thinking, but that's not how reality looks like. So reality is one, and it's met and known and experienced differently as Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. And of course, in between each one of those, there's so much uniqueness. So that's basically how the Vatan starts giving such an open, broad, non-sectarian claim. Though then it will get quite specific in the direction of Krishna Lila, a certain particular focus that for us may be the favorite fruit, but remains very open. So I appreciate the fact that you made that point clear about, okay, there are different fruits, and each fruit is one of those endless phases of the divine. And then you said inside each fruit there are different seeds, So the point will be in this case, following the analogy, okay, someone will say, okay, our fruit is Gaudiya Vaishnavas is Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan, which I wouldn't even say that in the sense that there are some Gaudiya Vaishnavas whose main inclination is Sakya Rasa. So there, it's not that doesn't mean that Radha disappears totally, but their main focus, because when we say Radha Krishna, also what do we mean? Probably generally we understand more Madhurya Rasa or this type of moods of service, Manjari Bhava, Radha Dasya, and whatever. But there are Gaudiya Vaishnavas that we know of, they have an inclination to Sakya Bhava. So that's still Braja Bhakti. No, but there we are adding some other flavor to the fruit. But as you say, even if we will say, oh, casually all of us happen to be inclined towards the service of Radha and Krishna in that particular service department, still, each one of us will have their own unique, irrepeatable experience. Even to that degree, that's what I like to call radical personalism. It gets that radically personal. None two people have the same experience in relationship with the divine. That's why Krishna says in the Gita 4:11, right? Yayatmam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajamyaham. As you approach me, as you worship, as you adore me, I reciprocate accordingly. Unknown two people will approach God exactly in the same way. Therefore, he will not reciprocate accordingly exactly in the same way to anyone, because each one is unique. So there is a unique experience, let's put it this way, of Krishna, of Radha and Krishna, Krishna Balaram, Mahaprabhu, whatever it may be, our Ishtadev, there will be a unique expression of that that nobody else will have. So, as you said, there's no need to compare ourselves to anyone. Even if we are all on the same tribe of Radha Krishna Bhakti, still everyone is having their own unique experience. So, what's the meaning of comparing, or what might, on top of that, trying to establish hierarchy, which is better or worse. Of course, that's what we humans do, of course. Following the analogy of the tree, I'm bringing a more dysfunctional version of it. Because the tree has many fruits, as you pointed, many seeds, and also many branches. But all of those branches are connected to the same trunk, to the same root. And we often do not see branches of the same tree fighting with one another. But that we see a lot in religious circles. Right? My branch is the better, or the fruits hanging on my branch are sweeter than the fruits hanging on your branch. These are more tasty. More birds are hanging out in my branch than in yours. Whatever it may be. So in this tree analogy, we have a pretty dysfunctional option where the branches are not only fighting with one another, but also, well, sometimes wanting to eliminate one another. This is the only possible branch. All those other branches are fake branches. They attach themselves fakely to the trunk. They need to be eliminated, and only one branch should remain. We humans are so funny, right? Tragically funny. So, and it's funny, on top of that, a very unique expression of that tragic fun, if we want to call that fun, is that sometimes, of course, you have all these varieties. Of course, you will have, I don't know, some Christian who will think whomever is not Christian is wrong, or whomever is not in my Christian designation is will go to eternal hell. We have those extremes in many groups. But sometimes we have this unique variety, which is, for example, I know many Christian friends, Sufi, other Jewish friends, who agree completely that my path as a Gaudiya Vaishnava is totally bona fide and will take me to the ultimate goal I am pursuing. That say, there are some Gaudiya Vaishnavas from other branches who think that my particular connection to my branch of Gaudiya Vaishnava is not bona fide, and it's not taking me to the ultimate goal of the tradition. So that's another very interesting variety of the dysfunctional pomegranate tree we are talking about. Right? Some people from other sister for sister traditions totally validate, appreciate, get nourished from who we are in our tradition, but people from our tradition, but from another branch of the same tree of the tradition are saying you are not bona fide, you are not getting the real thing, you are deluded, until and unless, of course, you join my ranks. You taste my pomegranate. You sit on my branch. And again, for me, this has nothing to do with the actual teaching of any mystical tradition, of any genuine enlightened seer of the truth. None of them, nothing of that will speak in those terms. It's just us humans becoming, how to say, making it embarrassingly evident how immature we still are, and how we still need to compare each other and establish who is better, who is worse. And I'm not condemning even those who do that. There is place for that in the unfolding of our maturity, right? Like we always give the example of the baby, right? The baby will, or a kid will say, "Oh, my father is the best father in the world. No, nobody else is better than my dad." And he's trying to tell that to his friends, and his friends are a little bewildered because they think the same about their own father. And then you have the first fight of your life, which all started by some form of sectarianism, which again, it's unavoidable. But the problem is when it could be avoidable, but we are still indulging in those things. Well, you are ready to avoid those things, or you are ready to grow and mature, look beyond the fence and realize there is so much diversity. And even if I'm deeply rooted in a particular tradition, from that rootedness, from being anchored in my particular pomegranate, I can look at the rest of the pomegranates and appreciate them. The beauty, their fragrance, their taste, even if it may not be my favorite, I can appreciate that it's favorite from someone else. That's the ideal non-sectarian embrace of the principle of unity and diversity. I mean, that's basically the structure of reality. Achintya, abhida, tattva. There's always something that is the same. There's always something that is different. Always. Always both are coexisting with one another at the same time. Unity and diversity, unity and diversity, unity and diversity. But for many of us, it's achintya. Not only is it inconceivable, but it's like bewildering, and it's so much for us that we cannot bear so much nuance. So we go for unity or diversity, and we start to embrace these black and white frameworks. But that's not what reality looks like. Achintya veda veda tattva. Tattva means reality. Reality is a paradoxical, simultaneous coexistence of unity and diversity at every single moment, in every single place, in every way. Again, you can say in what we are talking about, yeah, unity, there is only one God, there is diversity, different traditions. Okay. But then you can say there is unity, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but there is diversity, different modes of worshipping the divine in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Madhurya, Sakya, Vatsalya. Then you can become even more, zoom in more. There is Madhurya Rasa and Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Still, there is diversity in how each one. So no matter how much you zoom in and try to make it all one, still you will find some diversity popping up there. Because that's the framework of reality. You cannot do away with that. It's not possible. So we better get good at coexisting with that. And not only, as I like to always say, not only learning to tolerate one another, no? Because sometimes people will speak in terms of religious tolerance, right? Which doesn't sound so generous, right? Okay, I tolerate you. Okay, I tolerate that you like that fruit. I think I can tolerate that. Yeah. I think I don't need to kill you. I can't tolerate you liking that fruit that is not my favorite. That sounds still very primitive, right? If I say, I'm not killing Kanupriya because apple is her favorite fruit and banana is mine. I tolerate her. Yeah. So far, I haven't felt inspiration to annihilate her. It's like that doesn't sound so promising. So we need to not only tolerate each other, but love each other despite our differences and learn from each other and be nourished by that diversity. And Gaudiya Vaishnavism, as I speak in the chapter on radical personalism on non-dual thinking, there is a whole section on what I call theological cross-pollination. I like go continue with analogies, right? The cross-pollination and bringing different components and contribution from one flower to the other, and but it's in a nourishing way. So we can be rooted in our tradition, and that's necessary, maybe even before we try to learn from other traditions, because we may get confused. So one can be committed, rooted, anchored in one particular school, and from that depth, one can appreciate the contributions of so many sister traditions and sages without feeling them as a threat, without trying to eliminate them, without trying to fall into any type of superiority complex. You will find that in every tradition. Every tradition will have their own reasons to say, my tradition is the best. And I have this statement, and the Bible says Jesus is the way, the light. And I can say, yeah, and the Bhagavad Gita says, abandon all religions and just surrender to me. And Krishna is saying that, not Jesus. And everyone will find their own quote that will be quoted out of context, because all those quotes are not sectarian in nature. You just need to understand it in proper context, and they are not at the exclusion of other varieties of spirituality. So that's why we generally also need some guidance. So we can be protected from ourselves. And when we are getting too dangerous, literally, we can become serial killers in the name of religion. So we can have someone who can tame that beast and teach us how to be properly identified with a particular tradition or call, but not to the point of necessarily downplaying others, insulting others, discriminating others, stigmatizing others, what to speak of erasing others from the face of the earth. So how to gradually grow to that? Like Brihadbhagavatamrita is shown nicely, Gopakumar traveling, he has his anchoring not only in a tradition but in a particular relationship. He's going there, but on his way he's meeting so many flavors, so many pomegranates and apples and bananas and mangoes, and not only fruits but vegetables and other ingredients, and the menu is so, and he's not rejecting anything. He's somehow learning from everything, and that's not affecting his own faith to his own particular fruit or call. He's actually expert in integrating those contributions to create a unique flavor that still is rooted, in his case, in Sakya Rasa for Krishna in Vrindavan, but ornamented with all the different sub-flavors and contributions from all the people that he met on his way. So that's for us the template. That's the very first book written in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, Brihadbhagavatamrita, setting that particular standard. That's how we are supposed to walk on our path, embark upon our journey in a very non-sectarian way, open to nourishment, committed to our call, but open and generous and remaining students forever. So, yeah, I know that in the Gaudiya community, and in every community, again, it's not a Gaudiya community thing. And sometimes connecting with other communities is helpful. So you realize that whatever trouble you are going on in your community is also going on in every other community. Because sometimes you can become also overwhelmed. Oh, our community is a mess. We are not learning. We are going through this over and over. That's going on everywhere. So don't just hope for everything to be ideal and only then I surrender myself completely or I have full faith. No, messiness will be happening everywhere. But also there's always deep, profound, committed, dynamic individuals in every tradition that we can have as our ideal and inspiration, and that's how we are called to become, what we are called to become, and be focused in that direction. And in that direction, we'll be invited to integrate and learn from so many other directions as well. Because at the end of the day, making full circle, yeah, we are dealing with the infinite here. So, infinite possibilities, infinite paths to the infinite. Though we may be choosing one, in that choice, there's infinite possibilities as well, infinite array of experiences, and each one will be having their own taste of infinity. And nobody's better than anyone else. No need to go there. We are talking about infinity. How can we draw hierarchies in infinity? No, that's an insult to infinity, right? And there's so much paradox because again, those who worship Lakshmi Narayan will say, Narayan is the source of Krishna. And we here say Krishna is the source of Narayan. In one sense, of course, how can one face of God can be the source of, and there all those faces exist eternally. So these are ways of speaking, but we'll find tradition we say the other way around. Again, Sri Vaishnavas will say Krishna is an avatar of Narayan. And by thinking in that way, they go to Vaikuntha, they enter spiritual world. So it's not like that's apasiddhanta, that they are wrong, therefore they will be prevented from entering transcendence. No, they are there. So all this invites us to be very flexible and accommodate so much. I like this word more and more, spaciousness. Now, how to become more spacious, how to create more inner space to give place to all these possibilities, without the need of becoming rigid and narrow. There's so much fear behind rigidity and narrow-mindedness. And again, there is a place for that in the kindergarten chapter of the journey. But there is a point where we need to outgrow that vessel. Because if not, we can become dangerous religious fundamentalists and create a cult, literally. There are so many of them. So a few thoughts. Of course, we could continue reflecting on this, and it's an important topic that we have talked many times, and I'm sure we will continue to talk many more times in the future. But I hope that helps, Kanupri. I don't know if that shed further light on your pomegranate tree.
It helped a lot. Thank you very, very much. You made my analogy even bigger, and yeah, it helped a lot. And thank you. And I just wrote down two sentences I thought just came now to my head, which is to be mature means to be committed to our call but open, so we can see the other apples on the tree and love them. Thank you
Yeah.
very, very much.
Thank you. By the way, I love pomegranate, so I appreciate your analogy in particular. Okay, before moving forward to the next offering question inquiry, we'll invite you for a few minutes to our Zoom breakthrough, breakout, break open, whatever needs to be broken so we can access a deeper level of reality. Breakout rooms for a few minutes to discuss, turn together further in community. Further ideas that you may have, experiences regarding what we've just been discussing, and meet you back in a few minutes. So, welcome back. Thanks for coming back, though I know how difficult that was, but I hope you had a good sharing. Each one of you in your own unique, individuated pomegranate-like way. So, we'll continue with the next question, inquiry, doubt, sharing, offering, whatever it may be, from Kanupriya, this time Kanupriya, living in Germany. Welcome.
Hare Krishna. Yeah, most probably it's all of this, what you just mentioned. So in the moment, or yeah, the last week's month, the topic of war is quite present, at least in Europe, because of,
Not
yeah.
only Europe, I can tell you.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, I had many discussions also. We had a community meeting and a very emotional discussion came up, and somehow it's always the same, or there are the same questions. How is it possible that people can be so cruel? How can God allow such things to happen? And I mean, in our philosophy, we at least have the concept of karma, which can explain a lot, and this makes it a little bit easier, but still, I see that many of us, especially those who have really experienced a lot of suffering, for them it's very difficult to see Krishna behind everything. And so, and then 2 days ago I read in your book Evolution in Divine Love, and the chapter about metta, and you mentioned that The suffering is part of life, and the suffering is also embraced in the love of, the how it is, suffering is, shall I read it?
Yeah, if it's not too long, yeah.
It's not so long. Understanding that all suffering is held within the embrace of God's compassionate heart offers both strength and hope, helping us to comprehend and find meaning in suffering. And I read this and I thought, wow, this is too much. Sorry, it's not a criticism, but
No.
yeah, I really felt also for me it's so difficult to grasp this, that there is love beneath all this suffering. And yeah, maybe you can explore a little bit about this topic to make it more
I like to clarify because
central.
I don't think you understood, with all respect, that section. I never said there is love behind that suffering, like the suffering is God's love. I'm saying, even despite the suffering, God's love remains coming to us, which is not understood.
I understood this. Yes,
Okay,
yes.
just then I want to clarify for nobody to misread that as like, oh, you're suffering like hell, that's God's love to you. So it's like, oh, okay, that's He loves very particularly. So the idea is that, yeah, no matter. Yesterday I was recording a, and again, these are big examples, but big necessary examples of people that show all that we can be, how much we can hold complexity and suffering and horrible things and still find reasons to, it goes to smile and to find purpose in life, even when we are crying also, right? As they say, to hold both beauty and brokenness simultaneously. That's the capacity we all have to develop. It's not just about everything is nice, kijai, kijai, beauty, harmony, and that's it. Because we've become deniers of horror, evil, suffering in this world, and that's, I don't think it's healthy. And we become shallow and superficial because we may also may reduce all that to, okay, that's their karma. I wouldn't be that simplistic. That's way more complex than that. And of course, I won't go to the conversation on omnipotence and all that because I've talked about many times, and we can talk again many times. But again, karma is way more complex than what we think it is. I will say that, in my opinion, many devotees have a very wrong understanding of karma, very simplistic. And when something is simplistic, it's in one sense wrong. It's like very reductionistic, not nuanced, not deep enough. And we sometimes think, see karma, whatever is happening on the outside to us, that's my karma. Not necessarily. Karma may be more your inner disposition in how you choose to react to that. Now, the momentum you created by your previous choices that create a certain predisposition, while at the same time, there is still free will for you to choose in a different direction than the momentum you have been accumulating. Like, for example, there's this famous, I mean, maybe not famous, now it's famous for me because I've noticed that, and it's a very interesting section where Prabhupada once is speaking with, in a conversation with some of his disciples. And he said, well, if someone, he was asked like whether one should passively accept an attack as a deserved karmic reaction, right? You are walking and someone wants to beat you. According to, okay, it's my karma, you should then accept your karma, right? Accept it. And Prabhupada say, he replied interestingly, it may be that somebody is attacking even though you do not deserve. So that's an important point right there. Then they say, and therefore you have got intelligence, you have got hands, you may try to protect. In other words, he implied, someone may be attacking you. That's not necessarily you deserve that. That's not necessarily your karma. So in the same way, you can extend that analogy to situations like war or things that you are speaking and not necessarily reduce, okay, whatever's going on to every single inhabitant on Iran or Israel or Palestine or whatever there may be war. I mean, let's not Ukraine, Russia, and so many more that we don't know. Oh, it's all their karma. They did something in the past for them to deserve being bombarded in their city or house. Not necessarily. I'm not saying that in some cases that may not be, that may, in that some cases that may be the case. Because, I mean, by seeing what people is doing to other people now, naturally we can imply, well, maybe in the past some of these people did the same thing to other people. So, yeah, that's clear. But I wouldn't reduce whatever happens to anyone, as Prabhupada just said. It may be that you do not deserve that. You were just walking, so to say. Whatever, in one sense, whatever happens to us externally may be more a result of our own free will interacting with the free will of others rather than a rigidly determined fate. It's your karma. So if someone chooses to act toward me in a particular way, attacking or whatever, that specific act is not necessarily my karma. But how I respond internally to whatever that may be will indeed be shaped by my past actions, but also by my present choices. Again, I have free will. So I'm just giving an example of how we can understand this notion of karma in a more nuanced way, rather than just saying it's their karma, next topic, or it's my karma. To with whatever is happening, and who knows how we process all that. So that on one side, and again, I forgot to say what I was saying about yesterday. Got sidetracked. But yesterday I was recording a podcast with Manjali Willaik, with whom I was recording this podcast, and probably she already knows by me saying this. So I recorded a podcast with Patrick Woodhouse. So we did a podcast yesterday on Etihilism, which is one of the main themes that Patrick, he's a Christian Anglican priest, he writes about. I don't know if you are familiar with the life of Etihilism. If not, you are more than invited to get to know about her. Incredible life. Incredible and incredibly complex. I won't go into the details now. You have to watch the podcast eventually. But basically, she was one of the many people who had to go through the Holocaust. And she was not a Holocaust survivor in this case. We know about her by the diaries she wrote. And by those diaries, we can get a glimpse into how much she transformed her life first. Before that, she had a very dysfunctional young period in her life, very promiscuous, very up and down emotionally. And in the context of the horrors of the Holocaust, she experienced some deep transformation, conversion, while not subscribing to any official religion at the same time. But at the same time, like choosing to relate to all those horrors, not denying them, not being naive, but not going to the other extreme of becoming cynical. Now, we were talking about how these two are extremes, to be a cynic and to be a naive. Try to find a middle point. To develop hope in the midst of brokenness, hold beauty. Don't lose sight of beauty. And in while holding beauty, don't lose sight of brokenness. Don't zoom in so much into the war to the point that you lose sight of how divine grace still is entering into every situation. And don't become fanatic about divine grace to the point of denial of the horrors we humans can do to one another and act accordingly. And she will say, no, famously, then when she, let me literally read what she said, because she is a very good writer, so it's better that I use the exact same words she used. So she says, even the worst crimes, and she was witness of that, and was victim of that, even the worst crimes, I try to look them in the eye and find a small, naked human being beneath the wreckage. So that was her stance. Again, I know most of us will say, well, that was her stance. I'm not Etihilism. Well, she's showing all that we can be. So she's saying, even in the midst of all horrors and crimes and the perpetrators of that, I look them right at the eye and I can see that behind every horror, there is a naked, fragile, broken human being. And I'm not denying the horror. I'm looking at it right at the eye. So that's the paradox. By not denying what's going on and daring to look it right at the eye, you actually see beyond what you thought it was, and you see what's actually lying there in this beneath, which is fear, brokenness, frailty, a fractured being. And I'm not saying that because of that you just become passive and do nothing, but you can have understanding and you can have compassion and you can still move forward in the midst of those horrors. I mean, she was in the concentration camp. She was not like saying all that from a five-star hotel. And she was tending to the people who was dying and feeding them and tending to those who were sick. And it is said that the very last thing she said when they were leaving from Westbrook, which was like a transition camp to Auschwitz, where she stayed a few months before she was killed, the very last thing she mentioned in a postcard that she wrote and gave to a friend, she was leaving with another group, and she said, we left the camp singing, right? That was the last thing we know she said. We left the camp singing. I mean, she knew where she was going. And still, she found reasons to sing. So, again, of course, this puts us in a situation where we are like, how can that be possible? How, after being confronted with the horrors of wars and Holocaust, you still find reasons to sing, to smile, to celebrate, to praise? Well, she did. And not only she, of course, we have many other examples. So those are the examples, even if they are the fewer ones and we can count them with the fingers of one hand, those are the torchlights that are showing us the way and inviting us to become that as well ourselves. And when we do that, again, we enter into that paradox, which is there is horror and there is beauty. The fact that I looked right at the eye at the greatest horror makes me see this tenderness and fragility and brokenness of human being, and that creates compassion and understanding, which has it brings its own form of beauty. It's paradoxical, right? From a very immature or basic way of understanding, these two things cannot be accommodated at the same time. So that's why we need to grow to that point where we can live in paradox and we can accommodate the things that today feel contradictory. I would say, especially in the times we are living, where we are, not only there are wars going on, because wars have been going on in any time in history, and sometimes worse than this one in many ways. So let's not be also like, oh, this is the worst time ever. I mean, everyone in any time will be saying the same thing. The problem I will say here now is that on top of that, we have globalized communication. So you get all the news about everything that is going on everywhere, and it's too much. It's too much content to process. So I'm not saying become a denier, but again, I will say that a survival skill for the times we are living is to develop a capacity to hold beauty and brokenness. All those terrible news with all those wonderful news that keep existing. So that's, I will say, the dharma of our generation, of all of us who are living in this time and age. How to develop this skill to not deny the news that are coming knocking on our door, but not to zoom in only in that direction, become cynical, and lose sight of the daily miracles that are happening everywhere. Even in the midst of all that, if we look to that right at the eye, as Seti Hillesum did. So I think that's a basic survival skill that whomever's living in these times needs to develop. And again, it's paradoxical. It's not easy. It's easier to go to one extreme or to the other. I become blind, a denier, and become a harmony junkie and just Haribol, Haribol, so to say. Or I become a cynical and everything is wrong and bad and God is against us, universal conspiracy, there is no hope, better let's extinguish the whole human race, or things like that. There are many people thinking like that. So, how to find a balance, a middle point? how to hold that space on a daily basis. That's what we were talking yesterday with Patrick. How to cultivate that inner spaciousness to hold space to all the things. And then we can hold space for other people who will come bewildered by what's going on in the world. And if you don't have your own inner spaciousness to hold both beauty and brokenness, you won't be able to hold space for other people, and give hope to them. And people need hope, but a realistic hope, not an escapist hope. So for that, first, we need to work on ourselves, hold these apparent opposites, and keep them together with compassion and understanding and depth. Hold that space in ourselves to begin with, and then hold space for others. And that's in part, big part of the solution. So they can then hold space for others, and so on and so forth. That's big part of the healing in the times we are living. Yeah. And it's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying every day works perfectly. I'm not saying one day one will go to one extreme or the other. All that stuff happens also. But I think that's a very important skill that we need to hone, to refine. And it's never enough, especially the times we are living. We are being more challenged with, again, so much bombardment of information that, of course, you need also to filter how much you dare to consume, because it can be too much also. You also need to know when to put pause, zoom out, and zoom in other directions. So to hold the bigger picture, not to hold the bigger picture that is integrating everything, welcoming everything, not rejecting, not denying, but holding space for the totality of reality from the bigger picture of unconditional love, which at the end of the day is the force that is sustaining everything. Not creating the tragedy, not creating the suffering. It's holding space in that, even in the midst of all those wounds. Unconditional love is present there, whether we are aware of that or not. So that's very important, that we become aware of that and how that happens. Starting with our own life, before trying to go and solve all the worlds on planet Earth. Don't try to jump into that world-saving project, because it's too much, and probably it's the best excuse to not solve your own inner world project. That's how it generally works. Like, it sounds like I have a very noble ideal. I want world peace and to save the world. It sounds very nice, but maybe you are making it sound so nice, so you don't have to realize that's the perfect escape plan for you not to work on yourself. So we need to start at home, reduce war in our inner own being, reduce divisiveness and fracturedness at home, in our immediate relationships, I will say, and do what we can, of course, again, on a local level, to gradually expand waves of healing, waves of spaciousness, and waves of compassion and understanding. Understanding that still people have their own free will, their own divisiveness. We are not in Golok Vrindavan, let's be honest. So part of the history of this world is conflict and division, which comes from having a dualistic thinking, from being covered by avidya, all of that which brings fear, and in that fear we develop so many defense mechanisms, and there you have it, war all over. But war comes from fear, fear comes from having a dualistic mindset, us and them mentality, and that comes from being covered by ignorance. And like Jesus say, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. No, they are covered by avidya, they're in ignorance. That's similar to what Etihilism said. When I look you at the eye, I'm not seeing an inherently evil person. I'm just seeing someone covered by ignorance, fragile, fractured, by duality, fearful. And all what you are doing is just a coping defense mechanism. And while I may try to defend and take action, at the same time, I'm understanding what's going on. And I'm trying to, from that understanding, to revert the sequence through my own behavior. And that's a daily choice. I mean, we choose to be part of the war or not at every step and every breath of our day. It's not just vocally say, I'm against the war, I'm in favor of it. It's just how you live your life. So we're talking before with the other our other Kanupriya, Let's go with the Vaishnava. We can be very sectarian, very violent, very elitist. That's war. That's divisiveness. That's conflict. Maybe we are not shooting on each other. Hopefully, some cases they're shooting at each other online. There's like online inquisitions in the way they talk to each other. But that's fostering war in one way or another. That's adding to that particular side. So that's a daily choice at every moment. How do I choose to react, to speak, to think, to feel, to respond to this person, to this given circumstance? It's a lifestyle and being committed to that lifestyle. So it's not as easy as it sounds. So it's important that we commit ourselves to that. And that will, we shouldn't underestimate the effect that that can have in our immediate circle. And that, like a butt creating a butterfly effect, as they all say. But I don't know if I'm addressing any of your concerns, Kanupriya, with all of this that I say.
Yes, of course you did. I mean, I remember this famous poem by Dietrich Bonhoeffer when he was, also just some days before he was killed. I don't know how it is in English, but it always touched me very much. And there was always this question in my life: how can it be that persons in such situation experience really this kind of love and hope and
Yeah. And that's the real question, right? The real question is not so much why there is war and why I mean, one says, of course, I'm not against someone asking why the Nazis did what they did. You can ask that, but the real question is why someone like Bonhoeffer or Etty Hillesum or Viktor Frankl, in the midst of going through that, they reacted as they did. That's a main question for me. Or like Jordan Peterson will say in his own words. The question is not why people take drugs. The real question is why some people do not take drugs. In the sense, like the condition of the world invites for most of people to try to numb themselves. And so why some people do not do that? What takes them to not do that? So I'm not saying denying the other part, but as you say, becoming more curious about what took Dietrich Bonhoeffer or Etty Hillesum, whomever. Again, there are not only two or three. To despite the horrors, the betrayal, the violence, all the things we know, to take the stance they took, to live their lives as they did, even at the cost of their life, no? Like Bonhoeffer was killed, he knew, and many others. So, in spite of that, again, Etty Hillesum going to Auschwitz, she knew, I'm not going to Auschwitz as a theme park. No, I will be put in a gas chamber there. But they left the camp singing. So what they are experiencing, what they are seeing beyond what's taking place on certain level, which level of depth they are perceiving what's taking place. So we are all invited to become that. We have the potential to become that. It's not just Etty Hillesum, Kijai, and idolizing those who are doing the things I'm terrified about doing, because sometimes that's what we do, no? So we don't have to follow the footsteps of someone, we start worshiping them. Right? That's what Father Richard Rohr will say. Most people worship Jesus so they don't have to follow him. Yeah. It's easier to worship someone. To follow the person, oh my gosh. And Jesus never said, worship me. He said, follow me. And everyone ended up worshiping him. We can do the same with a guru. We can do the same with a saint or whomever. Just praise and worship and key overdose of kijais. So we don't have to become that ourselves. So externally, it looks very nice and very reverential, but it's all escapism and spiritual bypassing. Like I talked with Shalene Kendrick in our podcast some weeks, month, 1 month ago, that she will say, Jesus is not an example to us, Jesus is an example of us. That's way more scary. The same with guru, whatever figure you want to put there. They are not examples to you, they are examples of you, of all that you can be, if you choose to walk that path. Do you choose or not? That's another question. And sometimes we'll say yes, sometimes we'll say not that much, a little more, a little less. That's sadhana also. That's part of the journey. Till our yes becomes more solid, until there is nothing but yes. Even in the big nose and in the big darkness and betrayal, still the yes predominates. A yes to life, a yes to the call. So that's why we need these guardian angels in our lives. Now, these people that, even if they are not longer alive, their way they live their life is such a powerful testament that still is completely living, alive for us here today, relevant, relatable. As impossible as it may sound on this, as high as it may be, still is so real that even if I'm totally far away, it's too real for me to say it's not possible. I may say I don't feel it's possible today, but that's too real. It's real. I cannot deny it's real. And I cannot deny that's calling me. There's something in me that is calling there. It's my own potential speaking. It may take lifetimes. It may not be in a weekend. But as long as we voluntarily choose to walk in that direction and sincerely develop that aspiration, in itself, that's a warrant of all success. Prabodhananda Saraswati will say that in Sri Radha Rasa Sudaniti. I mean, speaking about the ideal of serving Sri Radha, which may sound something very different, but it's quite connected because to really surrender fully to the service of the goddess entails so much sacrifice and dedication and risk-taking and all the things that terrify us on a daily basis. And he will acknowledge, I know this is a very high ideal, and I know that most probably I won't attain that ideal in this lifetime. But if I can die aspiring to that ideal, that will be enough for this lifetime. I consider my lifetime a success. If I can die while aspiring that ideal, to that ideal. So that this is the situation here. Srila Samrash will speak a lot about the greatness of the ideal and how we are to be seen according to our ideal, not to where we are, but to what which ideal we sincerely want to embrace. Even if we are lifetimes distance, it's just a matter of time. You're already there in Krishna's eyes. So the important thing is try to find a good ideal, and a good ideal will be challenging enough. And you will be at the same time relating to that ideal in a healthy, sustainable way, knowing I'm not getting there that soon, but the ideal has such nobility, so dignifying, so deep, so charming that even if it take me lifetimes, I'm on my way there. And our acharyas will say, you are there already, one in that sense. You're already on the path to that, and the ideal is ever evolving on top of that, of course. Yeah, an important topic. I'm glad you brought that kind of prayer because, again, sometimes I also see the devotees saying, no, suffering, again, suffering, war, all this stuff, just reduce it to their karma. End of the conversation. And let's continue talking about how to chant rounds properly or things like that. And it's like, I'm not against talking about how to chant rounds properly, but part of how to chant rounds properly is how to deal with these situations. It's all part of one thing. No? We don't want to be living in a bubble. I mean, our acharyas were not living in a bubble. Mahaprabhu, his associate, they were aware of the socio-political dynamics of the time. They were dealing with that. So we don't want to be transcendental, quote unquote, to the point of blindness or to the point of too much comfort zone or to the point of not wanting to be confronted to look at suffering at the eye, as Etty Hillson will say, right? To have the courage to look at loss and betrayal and suffering right at the eye. That takes courage and vulnerability. And we need to become strong enough to do that at some point. So, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And let's go to a breakout room because this is a necessary topic to continue discussing, very current. Always current, but very current now today. So please let's spend some space together and time together, continuing to churn this particular thing. I'll see you in a few minutes. Welcome. Welcome you all back. Hoping you had a significant and meaningful time together. So we have a few more raised hands. Beginning with Rati Rupa, and I saw also Chandrika raising her hand, and I don't know if someone else. I'm not so sure if I will get the time to address all of the raised hands because today, for some reason, seems I've been inspired to answer in a little longer way than usual. And at the same time, I don't want to take more of your usual time. So I'll address Raturupa's question and let's see if the inspiration takes me also to a long answer or a short one. And based on that, we'll see if we can get to Chandrika. If not, we'll put that first for next Saturday. So Raturupa. And Balaram, next there. Greetings to both from New Zealand.
Thank you, Maharaj. Yeah, I feel it was last time I asked a question, also, I asked last, and you answered a lot of what I was already holding. And today, it feels that we are following a very clear thread or theme across all of these questions and answers, these quests and explorations. So mine is quite similar to what has already been discussed. And perhaps if, but maybe putting it into a more specific context and looking at maybe some practical advice that maybe you could offer in that. So the first question, and you was talking about this, the pomegranate tree, and you're talking about sectarianism and unity and tolerance, not tolerance, but also love of other traditions and this kind of thing. And then you've gone on to this point about the two ends of the spectrum of cynicism and what was the term you used? Naivety.
Naivete.
Yeah. So kind of this there. Now, I can recognize in myself a certain level of cynicism, definitely. And it leads to a particular kind of what I would call sectarianism, where I view other, I'm thinking within Gaudiya Vaishnavism, some other branches of the tree as being quite harmful, perhaps,
Based on hearing.
based on my experiences with those groups. And the doctrines that they present, and they even down to things like the way in which they preach and persuade and push forward those things, having gone through the experience, and you know that sort of the chain of events, this chain reaction that comes on, and like I want nothing to do with that. I don't, it's, I perceive the harm that is the result of that. Now, I have some personal experience, recent personal experience, where I have had to speak up against that, and it didn't go very well. But it's sort of like, is there valid sectarianism? I don't know, it's probably not sectarianism, is
I'd like
it?
to protect myself.
But in the form of self-protection, and I would, yeah, it, please feel free to elaborate on that point.
Thank you. Thank you. And I just realized that actually Rasangi had raised her hand before Raturupa. So sorry for that. If I have time, we'll go to you then and then to Chandrika. We'll see. Today is a particular day, as you can see. So, but regarding Raturupa's question, what comes to mind, of course, is if you are speaking up against something that is actually truly violent, sectarian, harmful, that's not being sectarian, right? I don't know. If there is, to give an example, if there is a Gaudiya group who normalizes abuse for whatever reason, hopefully not, but it can happen in any group. So if there are a particular branch or group or place or group of people who somehow make abuse part of their standard way of practicing, and you speak up against abuse, you are not being sectarian because you are not against a genuine expression of that tradition. You're just pointing to something that is genuinely harmful in the tradition or beyond the tradition. I may speak about abuse in connection to something in my family or my society, or sometimes the same thing happening in my religious group. I'm not against my family, my society, or my religious group. I'm just pointing to the thing that is harmful, which is not part of the tradition. That's the point in this case. idea is part of the essence of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. It's not sectarianism, manipulation, violence, I don't know, narrow-mindedness, and so on. So to speak about that, if that needs to be spoken of, or to take a stance in relation to that, it's not in itself a form of, oh, you're being fundamentalist, you're being sectarian, you're not tolerating us abusing others. Of course, those who are abusing, probably they don't feel they're abusing. So that's when the whole thing is complicated, because you will feel this abusive, this dysfunctional, this is whatever. And for theirs, this is normal. This is the right way to do it. And if there is no space in that case to have a conversation, and there's no openness to explore how that may not be what I think it is, then we may need to take some distance. Because if to begin with, you are not willing, hypothetically, of course, you are not willing to entertain a different perspective of your own situation, or to hear what I have to do. If you are not willing to hear me, there's no conversation. There's no genuine openness. So I won't lose my time. I have pretty limited time, so I won't lose my time talking to someone who is not willing to listen. I'm not hating that someone either. I'm not condemning them. I'm just being practical. And yeah, as you say, if you want to call that self-worth or self-protection or boundaries, or but yeah, I won't expose myself to an unnecessary loss of my time and energy if I'm clear that that will be a loss of time and energy. Of course, if it in the beginning I may try with hope, with the best intention, and invest my time and energy in trying to have a conversation, and it may work sometimes it may not. So in certain circles we can speak about these things, and when someone doesn't want to hear that, okay, I won't talk about that with that person, but still I have my own stance, right? I have my own opinions. I may be wrong or right, that's another thing. And hopefully I'm open to revise my own beliefs or ideas. But as much as I think there are certain things that are wrong in terms of abuse or whatever we are talking about, I think there is space for speaking about that, especially I would say when in some cases or in some groups, many times silence becomes the norm. Passivity, conformity, non-critical thinking, blind following, and people know there is something wrong, but they are not doing anything about it. They're not saying anything about it. Especially in situations like that, we may require voices, courageous voices that speak up for what's not correct, and that is presented in the name of the tradition. And of course, that has a price. There will be backlash, there will be haters, there will be people wanting to kill you, probably even, that it happened to so many prophets. That's the price of living the truth. Going back to what we were talking in the previous one, there is a price to walk a path of authenticity in a world that is not 108% into authenticity. So that's when we have the choice. Okay, do I want to betray myself and fit in and conform and compromise? Or do I want to speak the truth and speak the things I know that are true, in the way that is healing for me and for others? And I'm willing to pay the price that that may bring. So, because both things have a price, right? Speaking up has a price, remaining silent has a price. And again, sometimes we have to remain silent, not because of compromising my truth, but just because I know the other person is not willing to listen. In that sense, I'm silent. But it's not that I'm repressing myself, betraying myself. I'm just not losing my time with you who do not want to listen. But at the same time, I need to find platforms or people or situations where I can clearly voice what I think needs to be clearly voiced, to bring things back to normal. And especially apart from opening my mouth and voicing stuff, embodying that in the way I live my life. At the end of the day, that's the most powerful preaching, if you will. And because we can say so much and we can write so much online and make all the posts we want, But how I'm acting when nobody's watching, right? That's at the end of the day the litmus test. What are you thinking, how you are behaving when nobody's watching? Of course, we know always somebody's watching, but you get my point. So yeah. But yeah, as I say, I wouldn't consider pointing to some deviations or harmful patterns of dysfunctional dynamics. I won't say that's sectarianism, that's bad, that's violent. Again, depending how we say it, to whom, in which situation. Because again, if I'm with someone who is not willing to listen and I try to still shout to that person that stuff and jump on their neck and try to convince them how wrong they are, and they are not ready to accept that, they are not ready to listen. I'm not saying even they are bad and unwilling. They are not ready to process that truth, as probably you or I or many were not able to process certain truths at certain time of our journey. It's not that we were bad, it's just we were not ready. So sometimes we need also to be understanding and compassionate and know when to retire and not speak too much and leave a person completely overwhelmed, because that will be a form of violence also. So again, it's all depending time, place, and circumstance. Here, I cannot give just like one universal pattern how to do it. I trust your discernment in how to apply all that at any given circumstance. I don't know if
Yeah,
that
thank
helps.
you. Yeah, absolutely. Just a little bit to follow through with that,
Yeah.
just on this point about cynicism. And I think when I last saw you, you may not remember, I don't expect that, but I
Let's
had
see.
shared how yes, you, I'm sure you're very well, possibly Kat could remember. I was sharing with you about this book by Brian McLaren that I'd read, Faith After Doubt. And within the book, and he makes these four categories of kind of an evolution of, or progression of spiritual evolution, you could say. And he puts forth, especially the first stage is often containing a fair amount of fanaticism and rigidity, black and white thinking. This kind of thing. Now I notice I find when I look at that, I have very little compassion for that when I see that. And it's largely due to the experiences that I've had. Whereas I've heard other devotees whom I admire the compassionate stance and viewpoint they take on that, and they're, oh, you know, this is the kindergarten phase and they might grow out of it. But I find myself responding quite reactively to that. Could you offer any thoughts on that?
I mean, the main it will not be a thought, it will be just a question, an invitation for you to inquire into why I'm not with toxic guilt and shame, right? Not like lashing yourself, but why it's getting difficult for me to, and again, it's not only you, right? It can happen to any of us, but why it's difficult for me to see that particular situation with some compassion and understanding, and probably I get triggered into a more rigid place, into a place of, I don't know, I don't want to say condemnation, but just non-compassion and understanding, as you know, other people have, and probably as you know, you could also have, but somehow you do not end up there. So why? And again, I don't want here to give a diagnosis why that's the case. That's something you have to explore yourself, and probably in connection to your own experience at that kindergarten level, so to say, that you are witnessing in others. So if I have some difficulty in accepting their kindergartenness, how that reflects my difficulty in accepting that, how that reflects how I went through my own kindergarten chapter, and maybe there is something to address from that time, to heal from that time. So I can then look back at the other people's kindergarten chapter and deal with that more in a more wholesome way, because that's generally how it happens, right? If we have problems with someone doing something or being in a certain way, and that triggers us, that speaks about how we have gone through that, or how we embody the thing that is somehow mirrored back to us. So that's as much of an answer as I can give. It's more an invitation to further self-inquiry and introspection in one's own journey.
Yeah, perfect response. Thank you,
Okay.
Marge.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Greetings to both and to the family over there.
Thank you.
So we have a few more minutes, and Rasangi was the next one. And I have to honor Rasangi. As many times I have dishonored Rasangi by not allowing her question to come. So, I know Chandrika is Rasangi's friend, so Chandrika will understand.
Yeah, mine was
So,
just an observation, and I want to hear from Chandrika though, because it follows with what we were talking about today. We're in the same breakout group. But I have an observation, Maharaj, that although, like, part of me has been unleashed to learn and to grow, and I realized that for many years I was in a box, and now I feel freed and unleashed, and I'm eager and excited to explore and learn. But you know what? What is exciting to me more than anything, Maharaj, is that I want to come back to this. I want to come back to our tradition. That's exciting because we were always told if you go and explore that, you're going to get deviated, you're going to get distracted, you're going to get derailed. I'm
don't
just
speak
saying.
don't speak in the plural sign the same we always told that maybe
I
some
know.
cases.
But I mean, from old school, I'm saying we were taught this. I'm
On
not saying
your
this.
journey, on your journey, saying speak in I terms, in first
Yes.
person terms. Sorry, this part of the journey for all of
Anyway, I was under the impression that if I
us.
were to deviate and wander, which I did anyway, because I'm a bit rebellious, but I'm so excited to say now that I have this thirst for learning and growing, and it's unleashed this awe and excitement about my life. At the same time, I love my tradition, and I don't feel like it's in danger. I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, let's take that as an offering. I won't offer any comment because you said it all. And let's give space for Chandrika, whatever she has to offer that. And I may not have too much time if that requires an answer, but I'd share a few words before we go to one final breakout room today. So welcome, Chandrika. You can unmute yourself.
Maharaj, it's a double question, and you can respond to whatever you'd like to respond to. So some time ago, and this relates to, what I'm going through personally, the floods on Maui, the war, everything. I asked about, not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Supreme, and you gave the context to that, and I'm embarrassed I don't remember that context. So that's the first part. And the second part is, with the floods, I've personally had a, major loss. And devotees say that, if, or I've heard in my journey that if Krishna, I've been given a lot. So if Krishna likes you, he gives you a lot. If he really loves you, he takes it all away. So I'm interested in your perspective on that also.
Okay. Simple question for the last 5 minutes.
I know.
No, it's fine. It's fine. So I'll be brief this time. Sorry, because again, I don't want to over transgress the usual time we're having, and I'm already doing that. But I want to, again, these are important questions that we may have the same question 300 times, and that's okay. We need to drill in gradually. First, okay, this quote, not even a blade of grass moves without the will of God. That's nowhere in the scriptures. Okay? Just in case. I know that most of you have heard that. But again, it's up to you to also inquire, where is that coming from? If not, we can be passive consumers of something that may need to be challenged, right? And even if you tell me, okay, I mean, that's not in the scripture, but I'm not denying the Prabhupada shared that quote in one purport. And I'm actually referring to that in my next book, upcoming, whatever that will be coming. But at the same time, that's not in Shastra. And that needs to be understood in a certain context. Again, a text out of context becomes a pretext. Because if you play out that line to the utmost degree, which means even the minute detail is happening because Krishna wants it to be that in that way, then the implications of that again is we have no free will. And that's a huge problem to our Siddhanta. That's a huge contradiction. Because if we have no free will, we actually do not exist. Why I say that? Because Jiva Goswami describes agency, kartritva, or free will, is one of the intrinsic attributes of the Atman. So if you take that out, you are no longer what you are. You stop existing. But one of the intrinsic attributes of the Atman is that he cannot stop existing. So thank God. So, but my point is, if you play out God's potency, omnipotency, all powerfulness, to the degree that everything is already orchestrated and in advance predetermined and controlled, there's no space for any decision. Everything is already prescripted, which is not our teaching. So, again, how to understand that? Okay, again, that's not in Shastra, that line. But the idea will be like whatever happens in the context of God's reality. God is like again, going to an analogy, like a huge vessel containing, holding space for everything that is happening with unconditional love. But that doesn't mean he's predetermining every single movement because, again, entities have will. So there's space for choice. Right. So in that connection, again, we connect with some of the topics we were talking today. When we see some disaster or suffering, it's not the question why Krishna is allowing that. I mean, wrong question. You have free will, take responsibility. That's the actual point. Everyone has free will and they are doing what they are choosing to do, what they are doing with their free will. And then you have the result. Why to put it on God? What to say? Why is he allowing? It's wrong. If he will cancel those things means to cancel the result of our choices, well, basically to cancel our free will. We have to think in those words, right? If the war is a result of the choices of multiple individuals, right? It was chosen. It's not like, oh, suddenly we have World War III. Just casually, randomly. No. There are choices behind that. And I wouldn't say that was Krishna's choice. That was Krishna's plan. He orchestrated that for the betterment of no. Don't put poor Krishna to blame for all that. Again, so we have free will. Again, we cannot take that out. We have to take responsibility. And free will makes us take choices. Choices take consequences. That's it. Krishna cannot stop that because Krishna cannot make us non-existent. That's what it is. Krishna cannot stop the eternal existence of an Atma, which means Krishna cannot cancel any of the intrinsic attributes of the eternal existence of an Atma, which is one of which is free will. So it's not so much about why Krishna is allowing that or not. Again, that's wrong question. We are The question is, we can ask why this is happening. That's a more accurate question, but not why is he allowing? That question already has some presuppositions, right? Now, briefly to the situation of a devotee life, someone who voluntarily is putting himself or herself under the influence of bhakti, Swarup Shakti, choosing to dedicate themselves to Bhagavan. That's a different case because now we are talking about someone who is voluntarily choosing to participate in a reciprocal relationship with Krishna, and Krishna will participate according to how much we invite and allow him to participate, and he will participate accordingly to what the necessity of the relationship, but how much we are allowing that. Again, Krishna is not such a cruel guy that he will just impose on yourself and you have no choice whatsoever, and he will throw on you stuff that you, I mean, he will be himself. And again, I don't want to re reduce God to himself. But whatever ideas we have in terms of what comes to our life, yeah, we should, if we surrender, we choose a life of surrender to God. We have that implicit trust. I'm being loved by God, I'm being sustained by God, I'm being nourished by God. And whatever comes should be understood through those filters, not never in a way that feels like Krishna is chastising me, or Krishna is like, or even if you want to use chastise, but in which sense? Again, a mother can chastise the kid from a place of love. As long as you keep the coherence of love in the bigger picture, you can bring so many things. But sometimes we don't bring that, and we start to put Krishna's chastisement or testing me or sending this, but in ways that do not portray the divine as loving. And that's when we are in trouble, because we are creating a God of our imagination, of our unresolved childhood trauma, but not who the sweet absolute actually is. So, no, whatever the situation we may be in, a difficult one, a nice one, yeah, Krishna is always participating. In one way or another. I'm not saying he's fully orchestrating everything, because like Krishna himself says in the Gita, in every action there are many elements taking place simultaneously. God's will and participation, the soul's free will, depending each case, the gunas, the karma, different the environment. So again, it's not simplistic, like, okay, Krishna's doing everything, or Krishna's doing nothing. No. He's participating, he's exerting his loving influence as much as we invite him to participate in our life, but that doesn't also cancel other levels of participation. Again, reality is, it's multi-layered, it's complex. But at least we should keep that coherence in place, that Krishna always chooses to participate in relationship with us from a place of unconditional love, trying to facilitate whatever we need the most at any given moment in our journey, whatever shape that takes. We should have that implicit faith, and hopefully not blind faith, but just have, based on previous experience, that really we know that's the case. And that's why that's the main aspect of Sharanagati, or surrender, the Angi. Now, it's Gop Tri Twi Varanam, Jiva Goswami says. Of these six expressions of surrender, Sharanagati, Gop Tri Twi Varanam. To accept that I am being maintained by Krishna. And before that comes to trust that he's protecting me. So his maintenance happens in the context of his protection. It's not a cruel maintenance, like an owner maintains a slave, burly or whatever. So I'm being maintained by the force of unconditional love. So in that context, we can bring whatever you want to bring, and everything will find its place. But without the proper context, who knows with which idea we end up about who God is and what's going on with our lives. So that's as much as I can say, Chandrika, in the few minutes I have left today. Sorry for my brevity, but it's good for me to practice Zen brevity, conciseness. It's a good virtue that I need to hone.
Perfect, perfect, Maharaj. Brilliant. And
No.
in a climate event, I recognize it's not all about me, you know. So
Yeah.
so many are impacted.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm seeing here that Helga is sharing a quote from Jim Finley, who by the way, I was talking to him the other day. We are organizing to do a podcast together. He says, God does not save us from everything, but he sustains us through everything. So, yeah,
Ah,
that's
beautiful.
beautiful words from a beautiful soul.
Jai.
So, we'll invite you to one more breakthrough room, so you can share a few further reflections regarding what we have been just sharing, and then we'll see each other in a few minutes too, for our final goodbye, at least for a few hours or for a few days. Okay, welcome back. There you are. Hoping you had a nourishing time together, and one more time, deep gratitude for each one of you for showing up courageously one more time today, one more week, and it's our joy and honor to hold space and welcome you and share together like every single week. So deep gratitude for that, and looking forward to see you next Saturday, or for those who are able to join us on our new weekly series on Monday, studying the Srimad Bhagavatam, the living heart of the Bhagavatam. We'll see you on Monday. It's the same link we are using for now, the same time, but on Monday. So see you there. If not, see you on Saturday, and if not, stay in touch as usual. Srimad Mahaprabhu Ki Jai. श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय, गौर भक्त बृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः।